CB Shuckin' Jazz.
All you racing fans, stand up, clap your feet. I mean, clap your heads.
Welcome to the Goat Rodeo.
CRN Studios in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. This is Racing Through History.
Hello.
Hello, race fans. How are you
doing?
This is Jeff Gilder. This is Racing Through History. This is a Goat Rodeo. The Goat Rodeo. Whatever you want to say. Happy to be here. This is our post-Daytona show. For all you people out there that want to be topical about things. That's us. That's what we do. Let's get around and say hello to everybody. Let's start with the man on the street, Splitter, wearing the funky glasses tonight. How you doing, funky glass man Splitter?
Hey, I'm seeing a rosy picture of the world.
That's good. If that's what it takes, man, wear them suckers every day.
Hey.
Yeah, that's cool. Just not around here.
Why? At least I'm not from Wompee.
So you people that aren't watching Facebook Live, I'll have this up on the website in a minute, and you can just see how funky Splitter looks tonight. So, I mean, what's a 75-year-old man supposed to do, act like that for? How old are you?
Close.
All right, and to his left, all the way from Charlotte, North Carolina, home of Bobby's Auto Parts and the endless warranty, the Bopper is here tonight. How you doing?
Hey, Jefferson,
Bopper?
Good to be here.
Good to be here, too.
Yeah. On the day after, 2 days after Daytona Day.
Yeah, our post-Daytona show going up. So how's it all going, man?
It's good, man.
You good?
Good.
Yeah, good. All right, and just to his left is the mayor of Hand, South Carolina, Coastal Jack Walker is in the house. How you doing tonight, CJ?
Doing great, man. Coastal Margaret and I had a fantastic time in Daytona, and already making plans to go back again next year.
You know it's a good trip, man, when you start planning the day you get back.
Weather was perfect. Just everything was just cool. Neat.
That's great. Good stuff. Can't wait to hear more about that. Out west in the lair, the legend is there. How are you doing tonight, sir?
I am doing very well. Thank you, Jeff. Just looking forward to the post-Daytona show and hearing what everyone has to say about the Friday night race, the Saturday race, and the Sunday race.
And all of the other events that happened in and around Daytona with the history aspect of things. Cool stuff.
Oh, yeah. Jack and I can talk about that. Came for Jack.
Yes, sir.
All right. Now we're going to go out to Dawson, Vegas, Georgia. Cody Densmore is in the house tonight. How are you doing tonight, Mr. Densmore?
I'm doing pretty good, Mr. Gilder.
Great to have you, man. Just great to have you.
Thank you.
It was a good weekend at the good week with Chase getting the pole, the siren sounded, all that kind of stuff was going on in Dawsonville.
We were really hyped up, and then pretty let down.
Yeah, well, you know, they call it racing for a reason, you know.
Yeah, but
other names were taken.
It's a good week though. We I think Dawsonville definitely got on the brought back some attention, and I know definitely the pool room got a lot of attention with the siren. It was on several front pages of newspapers about it, and especially when he went on Thursday in the poll, and just the possibility of him tying the record with his father. So that was a big push for Dawsonville. So
cool stuff.
Well, did you think his post race exit was typical Chase Elliott? Cody?
No.
I couldn't believe it. I absolutely could not believe that of Chase.
What? I don't know that story.
He didn't want to
talk
to the press.
He just walked out. He said, "The hell with the press. I'm gone."
Yeah. Oh, you mean at the post-race interview?
None. Nothing. Well,
I mean at the press conference?
Nothing.
Well, he put on Twitter that nobody asked him for an interview because he finished 14th. All they cared about was your top, you know, three or four or five, whatever. So, I mean, I believe him that nobody went after
him. That's not what Fox said. Fox said they were trying to find him and he had refused an interview.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's
well, what I did he have a fuel issue?
Yes. Yeah.
He ran out of gas on the backstretch, didn't he?
That's what I. Yeah, that's why the way it appeared.
There was two or three of them ran out of gas right.
Well, he kind of bobbled, and when he went to get the reserve switch, it, you know, pump another whatever they hold a gallon or so. It, you know, it picked back up, but he lost so much momentum off that little bobble, he couldn't really make it back up. I mean, he finished 14th, which is not terrible.
Very respectable. Yeah.
For the circumstances.
So the case may have been Fox was a little bit too little too late. Maybe he had already said, nobody wants to talk to me, I'm leaving. Then they called and he says, I'm out of here. Right? Who knows?
There's a possibility. I mean, I'm not going to be biased, even though I am. But, you know, I guess if I was in that kind of situation, too, I'd be a little peeved.
Oh, I'm sure he was very upset. Absolutely. So.
Hmm. Well, you know, it was just a disappointment to me that he would act like that, right, regardless of whatever. But anyway, that's the way it rolled.
When all that was going on, I don't know if y'all recall, but Jeff Gordon kept saying over and over that Chase needed to forget the high side to protect the low side. Remember that? Jeff Gordon kept saying, I'm just uncomfortable with him running that high groove, that he needs to protect that low groove. And where he got passed was on the outside.
Yep.
Well, he ultimately got passed. Kurt Busch, and then passed him on the...
They also alluded to the fact that running the high side was the long way around, which consumed more fuel. Excuse me, and leading was also consuming more fuel. So I think those two things together kind of teamed up to leave him, less than a half a lap short.
Yeah.
But...
Feel like if he would have had the fuel, I think he would have been hard to beat because it just didn't seem like anybody was able to, the last 10, 12 laps, how many ever he led towards the end, it just didn't seem like anybody could really pull up to him.
Yeah, I agree.
He absolutely had a dominant car. There was no doubt about it.
Well, speaking about dominant, if you can win a race at Daytona with a car that's beat to crap, how the heck did Kurt Busch get that thing to the finish line and win? I mean, I heard somebody say that and I didn't hear the interview, that he said he pulled down out of the draft one time. It felt like he hit a wall, you know, because of the arrow, loss of arrow.
Well,
yeah, the right
not an arrow car, that's for sure.
Go ahead, Cody.
I said, you know, the right side of that car was completely torn up.
Yeah. Well, apparently when you're drafting, it's not as important what's happening with the right side of the car or the back of the car.
Yeah.
But once you get out in front, you know, it's big time.
Yeah. That's cool. I'll tell you what, man. To me, I've seen several races where that dude just drives his butt off, man.
He does.
He can flat drive a race car.
I used to not like him, but I've come around to him. I still don't like his brother, but I like him.
I've never been a big fan of Kurt, mostly because of his previous exploits, but I'll tell you one race that was impressive to me was when he was kicked out of Penske and he went to James Finch for the year.
Yep.
And that underfunded team, and he finished second at Infineon, Sonoma, whatever you want to call it, and he was really driving it, and it had a lot of damage.
He had broken axle in that race. You could see or something.
Yeah, it was shifting on.
Yeah, it was. And then the race at Darlington. I mean, that year he drove the crap out of that car.
But
anyway, cool stuff.
Yeah, you know, talking about damage, they talked about it on TV with several laps to go. There was only five cars out of the entire field that wasn't involved in some sort of damage or accident.
So let's talk about the format. Who wants to take the lead on that?
I'll take the lead because Hughes over there ready to throw stones. So. I think the stages are going to be good for what it is. If you're going to have a gimmick, I think it's a good gimmick. I don't think all the carnage at Daytona can be attributed to the stages. Hell, it's plate racing, which is a whole different story.
That's the problem, not the stages. Yeah. I don't disagree. I kind of like or don't dislike the stages part of it.
And I like the points part of the stages.
So that's encouraging. Hearing you old farts say that.
Yeah, it is.
But
it's got to be good for NASCAR. To hear, who's saying they don't like it? Do the drivers like it?
It is what it is, you know. I mean, what hell, everything changes, you know. And whether it's good or bad, that you know, we're not going to change it, no matter how much we like or dislike.
That's a great point. Yeah.
You know, I really think when you get to Atlanta and Charlotte and Texas and Bristol and you know all the other tracks, I think it's not going to be as impressive at the end of each segment, because at the first segment you had at the very last lap all of a sudden they came alive, and especially the second segment last lap you had, you know, a lot of fighting for position. But I don't feel like you're gonna see that different tracks later on, because they're not gonna be as close together as they are Daytona and Talladega. So I mean, if you've got 20 cars within 1 second of each other at Daytona and Atlanta, you're gonna have top 10 cars separated by what, 5 or 6 seconds. So it's, I don't think it's gonna be as racy as it is the last couple laps of each segment.
Yeah, but we're not going to know that until we get three or four races under our belt.
And if I could take the devil's advocate position, which I like to do, no matter what anybody says, if the drivers know that that's going to be the issue, they may be tighter than they otherwise would, because if you're running a long race, what's the need of fighting to stay up close like that, up tight? You got plenty of time to do it, you know. I like it from, and I didn't see it, I just like it from the perspective of what they managed to do was stop, and there's my dog Sadie, stop people from just hanging out and waiting till the end of the race to do something.
Well, and from that standpoint, I like the segment racing, because it does, it's kind of like back in the old days when they sponsored different laps in the race.
Yep.
And it kept them pushing all the time, because there was 100 to be won for this lap and 500 to be won for that lap. So you really needed to be in the lead all the time, or you know, up there. This in some ways is even better than that, because the only person that got any money there in the old system, of course that's been scrapped years ago, was whoever was leading. Right. At least in this segment, the top 10 cars get some points.
Yep.
Not to sound like a wet blanket, but I do not like the you're out if you go to the garage, right, and you've only got that stupid five-minute rule. I think they need to take both of those and scrap them.
Yeah,
to me, causes more harm than good, and it puts more of the race in the hands of the pit crew. And I still say that ought to be even a less of a factor, not more of a factor.
Well, I think that the negative to that is so much of the change that was brought on from 2001, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 and on, with the Lucky Dog and the Top 35 and all the crap they introduced, was keeping more cars involved for sponsorship. And if you got that five-minute rule and the guy's out, what's that do to that deal? That didn't make any sense.
I'll bet they changed that before the season's third over.
Well, the way I look at it, well, go ahead, Bobby.
Here's just an interesting thing that I come. I like to follow it when the race is going on. I just like to follow Twitter. And this conversation was going on, you know, while the race was. And Kenny Wallace come on and said, well, he didn't come on, he stays on. He said every single one of the drivers asked for the 5-minute rule.
Really?
That's the first I had read or heard that, and I more or less read another take on that today that said that it came from the Drivers' Council or the Drivers' Coalition or whatever they call it now. Did the drivers ask for that?
All I can say about that is be careful what you ask for.
Yeah, you got it. I think it's going to be changed or modified or something before too long.
Well, and tell me what the purpose is of having, if you drive your car into the garage, then they force you to go to the infield care center. What? I've heard one guess ventured, but let's hear what some of the rest of y'all think. Well,
if the car is drivable, why is it that you got to go to the infield care center? And that, of course, under today's rules, I don't guess it makes any difference because you're out of the race anyway. And I think that's just absolutely ridiculous that they, because you drove into the garage, you're out of the race.
Well, I think it probably has to do with Junior.
Yeah, concussions.
I think it has to do with probably NASCAR's insurance cover, covering their butts on any kind of liability.
Yeah, you probably got hit the nail on the head, Bobby.
Yep. I think it is a condition from the insurance carrier, whoever that is. Yeah.
Well, and, you know, in reality, that can't be a bad thing. You know, just off of some whim or some who knows what, somebody could have been injured and they don't even realize it. So why not check them out? It's just a walk to the infield care center, and
well, they're out of the race anyway.
By a professional, NASCAR now has their own traveling medicine show that goes with them everywhere, I guess, or at least that's the way I understand it, of some pretty top medical professionals.
If you're out of the race anyway, I suppose that's not a bad thing to do. My pick is the fact that because you go to the garage, you're out of the race. Which also means now that with this stupid 5-minute rule, you're doing all kinds of repairs on pit road that ought to be done in the garage in the first place. But I don't know. I don't like the 5-minute rule, and I don't like the fact that you're out of the race if you go to the garage. I think both of those ought to be scrapped. But
I think
the segments, I don't have any problem with.
To go to the garage or go to the infield care center?
No. If you go to the garage, if you drive your car into the garage, you are out of the race. You're done.
You cannot.
It doesn't
come
make
back.
Any difference what's wrong with your car.
Wow.
If the gas cap is loose, you're out of the race if you drive your car into the garage.
No, seriously.
And then, almost to add insult to injury, but you also have to go to the infield care center and be checked by the medical gurus. If you blow an engine, what does that have to do with having to be checked for a concussion because you drove in the garage?
No, it's only if you are in an accident and you go to the garage, you have to go to the care center.
No. That's not the way I understood it. That makes a little more sense.
Yeah, well, thanks for clarifying that, Cody, because that's not the way I understood it either. So, now we got it.
I think maybe some of the broadcast people are misinformed on that, too. Because they certainly made it sound like that if you went to the garage for any reason, you had to go to the infield care center to be checked out.
All right, cool. Rock and roll. Time to move on. Who wants the first piece? Next segment. Who wants it? All right, Coastal Jack, you get it. Coastal Jack Walker, Carolina Race Place, historic race finish.
First thing I won.
You're quick, man. Quick on the draw. Quick on the draw there, buddy. Quick on the draw. That's good. Yeah, rock and roll.
Okay. Tonight for the Carolina Race Place historic race finish, we're going to Greenville Pickens Speedway. April 28, 1973. 100-lap late model sportsman race. A 100-lap NASCAR National Championship late model sportsman race was held at the 1/2-mile paved Greenville Pickens Speedway on Saturday night, April 28, 1973. Promoter Pete Blackwell announced a week before the race that entries had been received from current NASCAR National Point leader Sam Ard. Ard would be driving a Thomas Brothers 1965 Chevelle. Jack Ingram of Asheville, North Carolina, had also filed an entry. Hometown driver and 1971 Greenville Pickens track champion Johnny Allen also confirmed he would be in the field. In fact, Allen was the favorite as he won the April 21st 35-lap late model sportsman race at the track. Another local driver, Butch Lindley, would be making his first start of the season at Greenville Pickens. Lindley would be in a Ronnie Hopkins Chevelle and had not raced since having a bad crash at Columbia Speedway on April 12th. The night started off with two late model sportsman heat races, which were won by Sam Ard and Bosco Lowe. The 20-lap hobby race was won by Gene Morgan, driving a 1953 Ford. When the 100-lap late model sportsman race took the green flag, Sam Ard quickly led the first lap from his pole starting position. He was followed by Butch Lindley, who started third. On the third lap, Jack Ingram passed Lindley to take the second position. Four laps later, Johnny Allen overtook Ingram to move into the second spot. On lap 27, Butch Lindley pulled his Chevelle into the pits with handling problems. On lap 61, Jack Ingram, who had been running in third position, managed to get by Johnny Allen to retake second place. Allen began to have handling problems, but was able to hold on to his third place position. Sam Ard took the checkered flag on lap 100 after leading every lap. Finishing second was Jack Ingram, who also finished second to Ard Friday night in Savannah. Ard won $800 for the victory from the $4,050 purse. So here's the way they finished. Greenville Pickens Speedway, April 28, 1973. The winner, number 00, Sam Ard, Pamlico, South Carolina, in a 65 Chevelle, followed by number 11, Jack Ingram, Asheville, North Carolina, a 65 Chevelle. Number 97, Johnny Allen, Greenville, South Carolina, a 68 Fairlane. Number 98, Brian Wallace, Harrisburg, North Carolina, a 66 Mercury. Number 79, Campbell King, Flat Rock, North Carolina, 65 Chevelle. Number 66, Ben Lane, Millen, Georgia, a 64 Chevelle. Number 29, Bobby Jones, Greenville, South Carolina, a 67 Fairlane. Number 28, Harold Brookshine, Travelers Rest, South Carolina, 63 Fairlane. Number 96, G.W. Gibson, Kernersville, North Carolina, a 67 Chevelle. Ken Medford, Clyde, North Carolina, a Chevelle. Number 2, Butch Darrell, a 68 Chevelle. Number 73, Billy Scott, Union, South Carolina, a 64 Chevelle. Number 24, Buddy Howard, Greenville, South Carolina, a 65 Mercury. Number 77, Robert Belcher, Campobello, South Carolina, a 64 Chevelle. Finishing 15th, the number 69 of Don Miller from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, in a 67 Chevelle. Number 27, Bosco Lowe, Fletcher, North Carolina, 64 Chevelle. Butch Lindley, Greenville, South Carolina, a 68 Chevelle. Ray Carter, Greenville, South Carolina. The number 44 of Donnie Bishop, Easley, South Carolina, a 67 Fairlane. Finishing 20th, the number 7 of Ken Thomas from Greenville, South Carolina, a 63 Fairlane. Finishing 21st, the number 2 of Bob Jarvis, Greenville, South Carolina, a 68 Chevelle. I believe Bob Jarvis was a dentist, if I remember correctly. And finishing in the 22nd and final position, James Britton. So that's the way they finished. Greenville, South Carolina, April 28th, 1973.
Sounded like to me a Chevelle show.
Oh, yeah, a lot of Chevelles, a lot of Fairlanes, a few Mercurys.
That's cool, buddy.
Yep.
Cool.
So they had a good one.
Who's next? You up?
I've already had mine, except I want to hear everybody's take on the all the festivities that led up to the 500. So I guess let Tim have it.
Tim, take it.
All right, take it with a legendorial, which I have entitled, Can't Believe the Change. Remember a couple of shows ago when I did the story about my first trip to Daytona in 1962? Things were really different then in so many ways, not only the racing, but the actual trip itself. Nowadays, and for quite a number of years, there are interstate highways that get you from Columbia to Daytona. Literally, the interstate is less than a mile from my house, and once on that ribbon of asphalt or concrete, depending upon where you are on the system, the only stop I had to make was in St. Augustine to gas up that Silver Mercury. From my door to the speedway was exactly 6 hours, including that gas stop. When you go through Georgia now, you traverse a three-lane wide each way, Interstate 95. I do have to admit that the exit indicators for 295 around Jacksonville could use some improvement, but I took a chance and I actually took the proper exit. The trip was uneventful as it was made in broad daylight, warm weather, no fog, and no really high bridges. When I exited I-95 on the Highway 92, Volusia Avenue that runs past the Speedway, it was just as the clash, or whatever it's called now, had ended and traffic was exiting the track. Traffic was not bad, but I believe the Cup qualifying was right after the clash, so folks were staying for that. It was kind of a special comfort in seeing the Goodyear blimp in the air from a few miles out, sort of like old home week with all my visits to the races in Daytona. A piece of nostalgia not lost on this old boy. When I saw my first welcome race fan sign hanging from one of the highway crossovers at the Speedway. But let me go back just a bit. Once upon a time, when you exited I-95 onto Volusia Avenue, the Speedway was the first thing you saw. In fact, almost the only thing you saw. Now it is tucked in between so many hotels and restaurants and has such an architectural facade, you hardly realize you are passing the World Center of Racing, where Lee Petty and Johnny Beauchamp, were Lee Petty and Johnny Beauchamp to exit turn 4 over the wall now as they did in 1961, the cars would end up in a hotel lobby. What the Speedway is now is far removed from the day Big Bill dreamed it and built it. That's a good thing, I suppose, but I can't help but wonder if there will come a time when development overtakes the Speedway property. Unlikely, sure, but it has happened to many a track over the years, thus Bopper's affinity for ghost tracks. Surprisingly, the welcome race fan signs were not prevalent as I drove on downtown to my beachside hotel. My hotel did welcome race fans, as did a few of the businesses on Atlantic Boulevard, the main drag by the beach. I saw not one banner from Monster Energy anywhere welcoming race fans. I even went into a convenience store for a Coke and checked out the title sponsor's display with no indication of series title sponsorship. The reasoning I've heard is that the deal with NASCAR was signed so late they haven't had time to make banners. Really? That baffles me, as most companies around here can make banners in 24 hours. I did see one fan wearing a Monster Energy NASCAR Cup cap. I was in Daytona for the Back to the Roots events. Back to the Roots is an organization run by Phaedra Lee, Zetta Baker, and Bob Hissom. And for just the fifth year of operation, the program Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday were exceptional. Such a collection of racing legends and racing history gathered in one place was enough to take away the breath of a fan of the good old days. There was no doubt at 316 Main Street, Bill Francis Gas Station from his settlement in Daytona, that they put out the welcome race fans with sincerity. This was a first-class program every step of the way. Bill Blair Jr.'s roundtable discussion Sunday afternoon was enjoyable, and I actually got to sit on a hay bale with Randy Myers for that event. I don't recall ever sitting on a hay bale before Sunday. The red carpet walk by the celebrities was something to watch. The David Reagan auction for Shriners Hospital was fascinating and raised over $5,000 for that charity. I saw things go for $5 that I thought were worth far more, and saw some things I thought almost worthless go for a couple of hundred. No figuring these race fans, I guess. The Marvin Panch Awards brunch was as professional as any event I've ever attended. The food was excellent and the company outstanding. Buzz McKim did a wonderful job as MC, and every award winner was most appreciative. It was an honor to have had a part in all that. Winding this up, I have to tell you this. I walked back and forth from my hotel to 316 Main Street, except for a couple of times the golf cart transported me. It was only a few blocks. As I was standing on the corner of Main Street and Atlantic Boulevard, I was listening to the DJ in the open-air bar. He was asking Daytona 500 trivia questions for chances to spin the wheel for prizes. I stood there a couple of changes of the light just to listen. First question, what year was the first Daytona 500? 3 or 4 minutes passed with no answer, so I stuck my head in the door and yelled out, 1959! Right, come spin the wheel. I gave that opportunity to a young man sitting next to the door. Next question. Who has won the most Daytona 500s and how many? I had to laugh at that one and figured that was sure to be a quick answer. I stood there for a while, not sure how long, and there was no answer. I told the other guy sitting at the table with the first one that it was Richard Petty, and it was 7 wins. He shouted the answer, and he went up to spin the wheel for his prize. Still think we don't have a problem with the preservation of the history of this sport? There in Daytona, a block or two from the Streamline Hotel, the young folks in that bar couldn't answer questions so well known to me, and I'm willing to bet to almost every one of you listening. I wish my friend Alex, the Florida racing fan, had been with me, and we could have cleaned up with spinning that wheel. But what the heck, prizes were probably a can of Monster Energy or perhaps an autographed picture of Brian France, neither of which is of so much importance to me. I heard all the discussion about the pros and cons of the new NASCAR rules that as they had been implemented. The disasters that were the truck race, Xfinity race, and 500 were mostly the product of plate racing, not segment racing, or whatever they call it. The fields in those races were drastically reduced due to accidents. Perhaps, and hopefully, Atlanta this coming weekend would be a better showcase for that rules package. So, until next week, happy race watching, folks, as Billy Biscoe so proudly displays on his race car. Don't forget your roots. A statement even more important today than ever before. Thank you, Jeff. And now I'm going to try to get that up on the blog site. And if I fail, good old Devin will take care of that for me. Thank you. Awesome.
That's cool, Tim. Is the president speaking tonight?
Yes, he is.
So that's what's going on. There ain't nobody on chat or anything.
Are you meaning to tell me that the president is going to outweigh this show?
I think he did. Yep.
No. He's waiting to 9 o'clock. He's waiting after our show is over.
Oh, okay, cool.
I got the number right here to the White House. Let me call
him. Call and straighten that mess out, will you? So the problem with our chat line is if the people aren't actively chatting, after 5 minutes, they drop off. It shows that they're not there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because the green light turns orange if they haven't chatted in 5 minutes, or something like that. I forget. There's a time associated with the green light, the orange light, and the red light. But all those lights mean that they've been on the site in the last length of time or whatever. So there's been a lot of people there, but they haven't been active. So
that's kind of like the green and white checkered flag they give at the end of each segment.
It's pretty much like that, yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Well, that was cool, Tim. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. So all of a sudden, the people started putting it back on that they're there because they heard that. So now the chat number went up. If you noticed that, if you looked at the number, it showed that nobody was there, but they're there. So thank you for showing us, guys. That's great. And I forgot what the colors mean. I'll go back and find that, but it's green if they've been active in 5 minutes. It's orange if they're I can't remember.
Well, Jeff, yeah. I'm colorblind, so it doesn't make a big whoop to me either way.
Anyway, okay, good. That's good. All right, cool. Moving right along. Who's up next, Bobby or Cody?
I'll say a little bit.
Bring it on, Reverend. Reverend
Stagger.
Stagger. We got Sadie over here.
You know, we've everybody, all of us have lambasted NASCAR and Brian Z and over all these the rule changes and so on and so forth. But as it turns out, in coming to their defense a little bit, there's an article up. I've come upon this same one a couple of different places. It's on J-Ski or the ESPN J-Ski. And the title of it is, and we can just kick this around a little bit. We already technically know it anyway. It says, Television Partners Heavily Involved in Format Changes.
Yep.
And television provided NASCAR arguably its greatest opportunity for growth. Now it will provide its greatest chance at recovery. This is a meticulous plan that includes a modified point system, segmented races, and bonus points that carry into the playoffs. The theory behind the changes, drivers will race harder, events will be more exciting, viewers will tune in, and more fans will come through the turnstiles. I think that, you know, one race is tough to make draw any real hard conclusions, and yeah. Daytona being a kind of a subject all to itself, it makes it even fuzzier to draw any real hard and fast.
We may have seen a turning point and not know it yet.
That's true. Yeah. But anyway, that, you know, that's hard to argue with that logic. If it makes it more interesting and it leads to greater fans, then, you know, where's the downside? And although a group of series stakeholders that includes current and former drivers, broadcasters, team owners, track and NASCAR officials all had a voice in the process of deeply changing the way NASCAR races are contested and presented, there should be no mistake that TV had its say. It's the old story. This is a quote from Eddie Gossage. He said, "It's the old story, follow the money, and the number one revenue stream in the sport is television." We've all unofficially said that for, you know, forever.
Forever. They're the ones putting the money in it today.
Well, there's a reason for those long caution flags after each stage.
Absolutely.
And that's for more commercials.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, did you see the announcement that Fox made with about 35 laps to go? Thanks to Toyota, no more commercials the rest of the race. Yeah. And then it was bam, 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 one commercial after the next commercial.
I saw that, Tim. I thought the same thing.
Did you also see that the ratings for the race were 6.6, some of the lowest they've ever had?
I can jump right to that. This I wanted to give you all a little bit of heads up into the thinking that went behind this, which we already knew, but this is an official acknowledgement that really the TV people were calling the shots. They were demanding. I don't know that they come up with this plan. I think their position was to NASCAR, look, you guys are falling through the ceiling. You got to do something to make this your product more interesting.
Yeah.
And they basically had this big high-level meeting last October before the season was even over and said, you know, something's got to happen. And this is just my spin on it. I think this plan that emerged was a result of NASCAR coming up with what can we do to make it better, and then everybody gets back together in January and announces it.
So those ratings at 6.6 were lower than the past? Because
I thought it was higher than last year.
This is a different article. Despite a new format and a later start time, Daytona 500 ratings could only match last year's near record lows.
Huh.
The NASCAR Cup Series Daytona 500 delivered a 6.6 final rating and 11.9 million viewers on Fox Sunday afternoon. Flat in the ratings and up 5% in viewership from last year's 6.6, but down 14% and 11% respectively from 2015. Kurt Busch's win, which peaked with 14 million viewers in the Fast Nationals, tied the second lowest Daytona 500 rating since the live start to finish coverage began in 1979. What is Fast Nationals? Is that a TV, some kind of ratings?
I don't know. That's a new term to me.
Let me read that again. Kurt Busch's win, which peaked with 14 million viewers in the Fast Nationals, tied the second lowest Daytona 500 ratings since the live start-to-finish coverage of the race began in 1979. Only the 2014 race, which was pushed into primetime due to a lengthy rain delay and faced the Olympics on NBC, had a lower rating of 5.6. Sunday's race also delivered the third smallest Daytona 500 audience since 1995, ranking ahead of only last year and 2014. But you know, the Daytona 500 has now failed to earn at least a 7.0 rating or 12 million viewers in three of the past 4 years. During NASCAR's 2000 heyday, the race topped a 10.0 rating in 7 of 8 years. So I guess that puts it into a little bit of from 2001 to 2008, it was topping a 10.0 rating, and now it's down into the sixes.
Yeah, Fast National is some sort of Nielsen rating. I'm trying to find the exact explanation for it here.
Now, here we go. Though the ratings were flat overall, Sunday's race did post growth in key demographics, including an uptick among adults 18 to 49.
I knew I saw something like it.
From 2.7 to 2.8. Ratings hit a four-year high among adults 18 to 34, rising 13%. Okay, compared to other sports, the Daytona 500 trailed every game of the World Series and NBA Finals. I guess that's ratings-wise. All three games of last year's NCAA Final Four, the final round of the Masters, and the race portion of the Kentucky Derby. Okay, here's something interesting. Greensboro, North Carolina led all markets Sunday with a 17.5 rating, followed by Greenville, South Carolina, 16.5, Indianapolis, Indiana, 14.4, Knoxville, Tennessee, Jeff, 12.7, and Jacksonville, Florida, 12.4. So out of all, you know, the top of the top, what's that, five markets, four is still in the old South. The old
and think about where those four are, Jacksonville, Greenville, in East Tennessee. I mean, there was a lot of racing that came from
and,
those areas.
And all of those areas are areas that NASCAR definitely decided to leave.
And they want to go to California and
everywhere else in Kansas.
Chicago.
And, well, that's old fans tuning in to
that's
see
old
what's happening.
Exactly. Yep.
That is
now, one of the things.
That is old fans.
One of the things I noticed that was a pleasant surprise to me, which is kind of something we've talked about over the last few years, is the next generation of fans coming up.
Yep.
And I didn't see any write-up or anything, but it obviously is that they've made a concerted effort to show children and the grandstand, to admit children free to some of the races. And I think that's a good move.
That's a great move.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They've been watching the monster trucks, ain't they?
Yeah, absolutely true, man. Yeah, you can see it there. Families in the stands.
Man. No, man.
I think if you're under 12, you can get in for free for all Xfinity and trucks this year.
That's great. Yeah, so I mean,
that's correct.
There's something going on. That's good. Somebody's advising.
Somebody's listening.
Yeah, somebody's listening somewhere. I don't know where.
Well, that 18 to 34-year-old uptick could be directly related to that.
Sure. You know? So. That's mommy and daddy taking the little one that wants to go see the race.
That's a new generation, if that's the case, and that is fantastic for the sport. You know?
Yeah, that's exactly what they were talking about, it back to the roots. For every child 12 and under that comes to a race, you can count on at least two adults accompanying them.
Yep.
Now, apparently, NASCAR has worked very closely with Disney to bring out this new Cars movie that's coming out. I'm not sure. It's only a couple of months away from coming out.
It's in
3D.
June. I know everything about it.
All right, good.
And I will see it.
Apparently, they are working with them to bring the kids through that part. Apparently, NASCAR is allowing them to use everything they want to use this time, whereas in the first one, they couldn't mention NASCAR. They couldn't do any of that. So they are hunting the kids. Absolutely, I think that's very interesting.
Listen to this paragraph from this TV segment. Mike Mulvihill, Fox Sports Senior Vice President of Programming, Research, and Content Strategy, told NASCAR stakeholders during discussions of a formal change that an average viewer watches 95 minutes of each race. An average viewer. And that each additional minute the viewer committed would raise the Nielsen rating by 1%.
Wow. Good gosh.
If they can just make
say that again, Bobby, please, one time.
All right. Okay, an average viewer watches NASCAR race for 95 minutes, and that each additional minute the viewer committed would raise the Nielsen rating by 1%.
That's incredible.
So if they can do anything, absolutely anything, to make people watch a little bit longer,
their ratings will go way up.
So, and the segment racing should do that.
Yeah,
interesting. All right, Cody, you're up, buddy.
All right. It might take just a second, so I'll paraphrase it.
Paraphrase it, man.
Actually, I wanted to talk first. I feel like NASCAR is trying to go in the right direction with history, because if you guys have been seeing on Facebook, every day leading up to the Daytona 500, they were having something to do with the number of days or the number of hours left, and they had some bit of history about the Daytona 500. So, like, if there was 195 hours before the 500, they'd find a clip of a race where so-and-so led 195 laps of the 500 to win. Or, you know, with, let's say, you know, I don't know, 21 days to go of the 500, they had a picture or a video of Pearson winning the 500 and all the people that drove the 21 to win the 500. So, long story short, I feel like they were doing a good job of trying to bring history back.
Yeah, that's interesting, too. I like that.
You know, a lot of young people are on Facebook, so I don't know if that could contribute, but the stands did look pretty full. I will say that there was one spot on the right on the front stretch, probably the most expensive seats right at the start finish line, that was bare in places. But once you get into the dog leg, out of the dog leg, it looked really full. So
yeah, I was really surprised at the I questioned my wife. I said, has NASCAR brought in a bunch of mannequins and the seats? Because the low numbers that they had for the truck and the Xfinity races, I was just really almost shocked at how many people they seemed to have in the stands, which was a good feeling to me.
There was some shots I saw on Twitter during the race that was the photographer was like standing right behind the pit area, looking toward the tribal. And from that vantage, there were holes in the. It wasn't a solid sea, which if the overheads looked like it was solid. But that's still splitting hairs. It was a good crowd.
Yeah.
Anyway, you figure it.
Of NASCAR race, it was an excellent crowd.
And especially with the way the crowds had been running, for the previous events at Daytona. So it was a good crowd anyway you measure it.
And there was a lot of people, Bobby, as you know, that go to Daytona and don't even go to the Speedway. They go to Volusia County or New Smyrna.
Yeah, there's a whole crowd that goes to Daytona for speed weeks that never hit the big race.
Well, I went out to New Smyrna. Margaret and I went out Sunday night for the K&N race, and it was packed. And it was a good race. It was beyond my expectations for the K&N race.
Yeah, I saw a picture of those stands, and they said it was an excellent crowd. Yeah. So there was racing still is big business in Florida in February.
Yes, absolutely.
It still brings a lot of people.
Yeah.
And even South Georgia is getting into the act a little bit from their
time. Jack, tell us a little bit about your Daytona weekend or week, beginning with the parade.
Yeah, well, the parade was on Saturday morning at 10 o'clock, and, of course, they stage – the cars for the parade, pre-1958 or before cars, in a lot across from the North Turn restaurant, and that lot was full of cars. I didn't count them, but I would guess probably 50. And
last year my best count was 45. So yeah.
I didn't count them, but it was full.
Yep.
And a lot of socializing going on. There's a lot of people hanging around. Humpy Wheeler was one of them. I talked to him for a while. Several people you would expect to see there.
Was Chocolate Myers there?
Oh, yeah, Chocolate was there. Matter of fact, it's interesting. I talked to Chocolate Myers. Well, actually, I talked to his wife, and he heard me. He was right beside her, asking about pictures of when his father went to England with Curtis Kreider in that group. They say they have pictures, so I'd love to see some of those. Hmm. But that's a whole different story. But anyway, the parade took off at 10 o'clock, went down A1A, to the end, came back up on the beach. There was the most people I've ever seen, and this is the third time I've been to the beach parade. Most people I've ever seen, both on the paved road, on the beach, and in the condos looking down.
That was my feeling, Jack. I saw that picture on the beach at the finish line, and the people themselves, the spectators, looked tremendous. The crowd there was that was impressive.
And then after the race, the cars go back to that same lot across the street. The driver, who's ever driving, gets out and talks to the fans and people that have come. And, of course, over at the North Turn, they do interviews. Chocolate Myers does interviews from, I don't know what time it started, probably 11:30 or 12 to 2 o'clock. And, it was good. It was excellent, actually. So I enjoyed that tremendously. Sunday, like I said, we went out to New Smyrna for the K&N race, which was fantastic Sunday night. Monday, we went over to the Back to the Roots thing at the station, Main Street Station. That was Monday, and that was a great event, the red carpet and et cetera. And, Tim was there, and Jimmy Johnson, several Racers Reunion members, and just had a ball.
Yep, sorry I didn't get to go this year.
I'm definitely going back next year.
Deal.
It got me fired up.
Did they notice your goat rodeo hat? Anybody?
I had a couple people. They came up to me. It's funny. Sometimes you don't see people on chat here, but you know they're listening. Because a couple people said, well, you said you're going to look for the goat rodeo hat.
Yep. So, Cody, did you finish?
I didn't really start.
I was thinking that, gosh, Cody, I don't remember him saying nothing.
Yeah, go ahead, Cody. Take it away, buddy.
We sort of hijacked.
All right. It's all right. I'm used to the hijack.
We've abused this kid for years.
Since he was 11.
If I don't finish, then I will continue on next week.
You got it. It's a deal, man. It's a deal.
I pulled this one from the archives. This was written by me August the 30th of 2011.
Sweet!
That wasn't yesterday. But this is the history of Atlanta Motor Speedway since we're going there. And hopefully we can stay there for the next couple of years. I had a prediction last year that Atlanta was going to be closing soon. Within the next 4 to 5 years that they'd lose their date because they were pushed back to, the cold months of February, early March. But it looks like they're wanting to repave it in Texas too, and I don't quite understand that if they can't draw that good of a crowd. But so anyway, the Atlanta Motor Speedway was planned in 1958 by Walker Jackson, Lloyd Smith, Garland Bagley, Ralph Cineo, and Ike Supporter. The Atlanta International Speedway, just south of Atlanta, was to become the seventh super speedway of the time in NASCAR. Now at the time, the super speedways as we know it wasn't always called super speedways. If there was a track that just wanted to become a super speedway, well, they just became the super speedway. So before construction, the proposed speedway had been completed. Insufficient funds forced four of the founders to abandon the project. Dr. Warren Grimmel, Bill Boyd, Jack Black, and Art Lester joined Bagley in the venture and spent $1.8 million to get the facility ready. When the track was ready, it really wasn't ready. Parking was bad, some seats were so low that you couldn't see over the concrete wall in front stretch, and the only restroom on the entire property was in the mud-filled infield and was in reality a three-hole outhouse. So more costly improvements had to be made before they could make back their millions of dollars spent on the track. After several setbacks from their goal of the first race in 1959 and two rain dates later, the track had its first NASCAR stint on July 31st, 1960. A Daytona driver, Fireball Roberts, and a Pontiac No. 22 won the Dixie 300 with over 25,000 people witnessing history. Now, since this was a NASCAR-sanctioned race, you'd think the founder and then president would be on hand, but actually, Bill France was stuck in traffic for the entire race. At the time, there was no such thing as I-75, so he had to take the back roads. The local police from Jonesboro, Georgia, were no help with traffic since they thought fans should be at church on Sunday, and they thought the track was just a menace. Many thought the first race was not good at all. Some said they'd come back until they passed, till they died. It was this mixture of feelings that improved the track to what is known as today. The first few years were rough for Atlanta International. In fact, they were almost bankrupt three times before things got steady in the mid-1970s. Even though things were shaky, they always knew how to draw a crowd. Jimmy Moss Steller was the announcer, Ernie Moore and Wayman Milam alternating flagging the race. Alf Knight was the promoter, and you had an all-star lineup of drivers such as Rex White, the Petties, Fireball Roberts, Tiny Lund, Marvin Panch, Jack Smith, and Fred Lorenzen, just to name a few that would always draw in crowds. In 1962, fans got to see the fan favorite and hometown hero Rex White take his only Atlanta win in his golden white number 4 Chevrolet. It would be one of Rex's best seasons since his only championship came in 1960. In the late 60s, after changing through many presidents and executive members, Nelson Weaver held the reins for a short while, but declared bankruptcy around 1968. Then the track had finally found a stable pair of Walter Nix, an airplane dealer, and L.G. DeWitt, a trucking company owner, and later a Cup team owner. The duo of Nix and DeWitt knew NASCAR, and they knew what the fans wanted to see, and they knew what the drivers wanted to see. At this point in time, they held two races a year, most of the time in March, April, and then October and November. And I was just looking, actually, a little while ago, and 1961 was the only year that they held three races, one the spring, summer, and the fall. So by the time Benny Parsons had won the 1973 Winston Cup Championship, Atlanta was quickly becoming one of the most favored tracks on the circuit. Some more changes were made concerning the track, like adding more grandstands and improved infields and parking, along with a better concession stand and restrooms. Like I said, in the 70s, when it was still considered good racing, Atlanta was a favorite for both the fan and the driver. One particular race in 1978, during the end of the season, in closing to Cale Yarborough's third consecutive championship, Richard Petty was in a door-to-door battle with Donnie Allison for the last dozen laps or so. Donnie was flagged the leader at the end of the 500-mile race, and this was before electronic scoring. Richard knew he had won, and he thought it was a mix-up in the scoring, so once he voiced his opinion to the track officials and NASCAR, he was declared the winner of the race. So Allison's car was rolled out of victory lane, and 43 was in. Soon, Donnie done the same thing Richard done, and just as Petty was finishing his victory Pepsi, his car was rolled out of victory lane, and Donnie's was back in there. NASCAR had changed their mind yet again. That's probably about the only time that's been done.
Sounds like the Oscars.
In both 1980 and 1983, the track was used in two different movies starring Burt Reynolds, Smokey and the Bandit 2 and Stroker Ace, which featured some of the greats of the track, including Dale Earnhardt, who is the all-time winner at the track on both configurations with 10 wins. In November of 84, hometown boy Bill Elliott grabbed the pole for the Coca-Cola 500, but lost the race to Dale Earnhardt. He would have to wait until his breakthrough year in 85, where he earned 2 poles and 2 wins at both races. He had another pole in 86 and his third Atlanta points race in the fall of 87. Bill won the only all-star event held at the track in May of 86. Then president of the track, Mike Helton, who is now the NASCAR president, planned it for Mother's Day to honor the racing moms. That was a mistake. With the truckload of roses that they ordered for the 25,000 expected ladies, they kept a whole lot of them. Reports say there were 18,000 in attendance, but some say it looked only like 5,000 because they only had the front speech. Must be NASCAR.
No, that's Trump calling me back.
But anyway, I'm about halfway through, but we'll go ahead and end it there, and I'll pick up next week.
I like it. That's cool, man. That's you wrote good. That. Did you write that, really?
Yeah, I wrote that 2011, so what is that, 6 years ago?
Is it on our site?
Yeah.
That is so cool, man. I don't remember that. That's great, man. Great
piece.
Well,
you don't remember that because I guess I talked a little different 6 years ago. It was a whole different ball game. It sounded different.
That's great, man. That's cool.
Yeah, voice dropped 2 or 3 octaves.
Yeah. All right, folks, that's a wrap. Thanks so much for tuning in, folks. Thanks to all of you that helped put this together. That was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it. And as always, we want to say a special thanks to the men and women in our military. Thank you for doing what you do so that we can all do this. To each and every one of you, good night and God bless.
Night, everybody.